っと食べるの。
Ladies and gentlemen, dudes and dudesses out there, welcome back to another episode of Peach and the Colonel. I am the Colonel, believe it or not, and with me here is the lovely, the one and only Peach.
Here I am. Yeah. Colonel, dudettes versus dudesses.
Oh.
You just said dudesses. I thought it was a dudette.
I thought I said dudettes.
Oh, I thought you said dudesses. I thought that's kind of a cool morphic thing, the dudettes.
I could have said it. I try not to look back, Peach. Yes. I try and just keep moving my mouth.
Keep
and
going.
hope it doesn't get me in trouble.
We'll end up somewhere we want to be. Yeah,
exactly. Look, it's been a long way. It's been a long day today. I've been getting trained in the art of four-wheel driving, of all things.
What are the central sort of components of good four-wheel driving?
Not crashing, not tipping the vehicle, that's a big one.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's really interesting. I thought I'd turn up and just be like, yeah, I know how to drive. Like, I can colour in between the lines.
Yep.
But as it turns out, there's a lot of different ways you use the clutch, like low gear. You can start the car without... Have you driven a manual before?
No.
Okay, so
not a manual girl.
In a manual, you put the clutch in to disengage the gear. You turn the car on, and then you have a balance of accelerator and letting the clutch out. So as the plates engage, you provide power to the powertrain. These things are geared so low that you just turn the key on and it just goes and it just starts. You don't have to push the accelerator. It just goes really slowly and it just moves. So there's parts of it where you really engage. There's other parts where your job is just to do nothing other than steer.
And let the car do its thing kind of thing.
He called it walking, and it just, you know, the car just keeps doing its thing and you just got to keep it pointed in the right direction. Climbing 45-degree hills and going on 28-degree, you know, sideways thingies. It was cool. It was cool.
Sounds
I like
very
that
cool.
sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So that was my day. Breaks it up a little bit.
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
Something different. I always like it when you do something a bit different or unusual. Do you think it's made you a better just general driver, or is it just a four-wheel drive thing really?
It sort of reminds me of back in the day when I was like, when I was a stoner and I'd play PlayStation for, you know, 8 hours on end, like, SSX snowboarding, it was called Tricky, SSX Tricky. And I'd play that for so long that when I'd eventually, you know, leave the house, everything was, I'd just look at the world like it was
in
an obstacle
land.
Course that you could, you know, you could slide down that ramp and you could get
good
air. Do you
think that's how parkour came about?
Absolutely.
From a lot of
guys, you just saw life like a video game.
Yeah, kind of computer game nuts, making life a game.
Anyway, now I look at the roads and, you know, I'm just thinking about
how you could go sideways along them.
Yeah.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, how much I'd have to fang it before my car would climb that building.
Before the Commodore would do what you needed it to.
Yeah, but no, awesome. And look, you said before, like doing things, something a little bit different.
Yeah.
And we've touched on this and we're still really, we still want people's suggestions for the Colonel's weekly or monthly challenges to keep rolling in, because I want to try stuff, you know.
Yeah.
I want to know what's out there, and if other people are doing stuff that is good, I want in.
Actually, Colonel, I've been meaning to ask you, because I know that you've been doing a little bit of Pilates of late. Have you ever tried a bar class?
Bar class?
Like on a ballet bar? So it's a sort of weird combination of Pilates with a kind of ballet bar style aerobics put into it. Lots of what are those things called? You know, like you're using the physio, the TheraBands. Thank you. Yes, TheraBands. Lots of TheraBand use. The sort of small ball that you kind of use under the small of your back in Pilates. A lot of that over the top of your head. That sort of thing while you balance on one leg. It is the most incredibly good workout.
Yeah,
I really enjoy it.
Just getting this mental image of myself in tights with a with a modest codpiece with my spiky ball above my head doing a plié or something.
Yes, beautiful. Exactly.
And I like what I see.
You Peter. Like it? Something about the image of a codpiece, which is particularly appealing. You would David probably be Bowie, the only man in the class. I have to put it out there.
Yeah.
It's a very female-dominant kind of class. But
well, I've always resonated quite well with, like, boot camps and group fitness. And that was always the case. It was just me and the ladies.
Oh,
like,
really? Okay, that's mums. Interesting. Yeah.
It would be like these 40-something-year-old mothers of four who were just amazing.
Yeah.
Like they could tolerate so much discomfort and just, you know, we'd punch bags together and stuff. And I mean, it's amazing. I was always so much bigger than all of them. But
yeah.
They just had a ticker that really admirable.
Yeah.
But I look at
you
I
often hear coaches talk about that, don't they? With different players, like particularly with football, you know, he had the run on him, but he just didn't have the heart.
Yeah.
You know, you hear that a lot, and it's true that you got to have a bit of steel in you to be getting up at 5 a.m. and boot camping. Yeah,
and this is the issue now with kids' sport. They don't let them score the games. You know, it's all this, it's just about participation. It's bullshit, you know. The world has changed in so many good ways. I'm not saying everyone has to be into sport, but the world has changed in so many good ways because sport brings out in people, it shows people that they can do stuff that they didn't think they could do. And it may just be your Pilates class where you've got someone sitting there going, no, five more, and you're at breaking point and you think you can't do anymore, and then you do.
Mm.
And you transcend your own sense of your abilities.
Mm.
And without that person and without that structure, that thing that made you go that extra mile, it just wouldn't have gone.
Yeah, yeah.
So whatever it is, I don't – like sport, winning shouldn't be the be-all and end-all, but giving your best and pushing yourself further than you've ever been.
Yeah.
That's a wonderful, wonderful part of life.
Absolutely. And that's why those sort of team environments are pretty good with that, because you will just go that extra mile.
Oh,
yeah. Because you're in that space, you know, because somebody's yelling or because, you know, you do just think, okay.
Look, in training today, we had this super steep hill and not much room to sort of get a run on it.
Mm.
And it was so steep that if, you know, you just get half up and you just sort of scramble your way down and really flip over. And it took, like, the fact is, if there wasn't an instructor there saying, okay, now what you did was this, what you've got to do is this, like, it might have taken 5 or 6 times to try and get up it. But that's what's made humanity great.
Mm-hmm.
We learn from each other's mistakes, and we, you know, we use our, you know, by making noises with our mouth and making the right faces, I can change the way that you live your life.
Yeah.
I can make you better.
Yeah.
And conversely, I can make you worse with the sounds that I make with my mouth.
It's kind of disturbing, isn't it? Yeah. It's
so powerful.
Yeah. It's really interesting. We've had a little bit of a break, as you know, Colonel, and in that time I've done a show and made myself entirely exhausted. And as a result of the exhaustion, I've spent a lot of time on the couch of late. I've just been enjoying my Fetch TV. And one of the things that for some reason really caught my eye the other night was the ad for the History Channel. And there was
Fetch TV?
Oh, it's like the Optus sort of Optus version of a Foxtel type thing. Sort of a.
Is it streaming on demand sort of thing?
Yeah, but it's also like limited. There's like limited Foxtel channels. Like, you know, you can get your E News and your sort of Style channel and those kind of, you know, BBC Worlds on there. You know,
but it just runs
sort of
on a schedule. It's not like you're just picking and
streaming. Yeah, exactly. Like that. Yeah, but you can kind of record it if you want to and all that sort of stuff. I don't know. It just came in the package.
Yep.
And the History TV it's a good package. It came with a codpiece. but the History Channel had a guy, some Scottish bloke who does a lot of those kind of Why Scotland's an Amazing Country kind of documentaries. He was saying in a kind of really intense voice, you know, what makes us human is that we have to look back on history and learn from our mistakes. You know, that is actually what being human is, that history is a concept created by us, you know, that the past is a very particularly human notion, really.
Yeah.
That, you know, other animals don't sort of look back. but we do.
And what's fascinating? In a lot of languages, like Chinese, for example, it doesn't have grammar. So they don't talk about past tense, present tense, future tense. Mm. Things just are.
Yeah. Like, and that's why so many students learning English find that particularly difficult about our language.
It's very difficult.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not as hard, you know, like languages that have masculine and feminine, that just seems a bit silly to me.
Mm.
But then to the Chinese, grammar seems pretty silly as well. Like they get by without it. But it changes the way they think. Yeah. Once again, they're not thinking about potentials in the way that we do. Like we're all thinking about that we're all beautiful, delicate snowflakes and, you know, what could I be and whatever. They're just like, what do I have to do now? You know, what's my purpose now? What's next? Yeah, do the right thing. So it changes. That little tiny
language
bit of
really
language
does shape culture. Absolutely. Yeah. Shapes our whole notion of identity, really. Yeah. It's very interesting. I'd like to speak to somebody who's into their linguistics to find out more about that, about how it does shape actually how we say it. I guess the thing is, if you don't have the word for it in your language, then you're less likely to need the word. I often find that with German, you know, they have so many lovely words for certain states of being that we don't have. I can't think of any examples.
But then you
got
like,
head, but,
you yeah. read Dickens, for example, and Dickens isn't concise. It's beautiful because you have to, it talks around the point. You know, the fact that there's not a word for that thing that you
particular
feel,
thing,
it's delicious language because you have to, and it's like when you say that thing, if it's got a word, it's like, oh, it's like once you give it a word, it's not special anymore. It's not it's not an individual experience. It's just, oh, you did that thing that everyone else does as well.
Yeah, okay, yeah. That's an interesting notion. Kind of kills the language journey if you've got a word for it in a way. Yeah, it's interesting.
And, I mean, the more you live in life, like you think, you know, I remember the days when we were 16 sitting around drinking booze and smoking cigarettes and coughing our lungs out and, like, you know, you talk about these discoveries you make as if, you know, as if you're the first person to ever discover it. It's so exciting. And then at our, you know, now you're in, I'm in my 30s and I look back and I hear young people, well, not just young people, but I hear people talking about things like, you know, a good mutual friend of ours that comes to me and talks about how healthy food and cooking that he's into.
Amazing.
And it's like, been doing this for years.
Tell me something I don't know.
I'm really happy to share it, but like you know, it's funny how when somebody's experiencing something, it feels like they're inventing it, you know. Some people in life own that knowledge and that experience, and other people, when they experience something, they're constantly looking for, oh, what's that called? Oh, they need someone else to validate that that's a thing.
Yeah.
It's a really different mindset.
That is an interesting, that different perspective and the way you kind of filter experience.
And just going back to my training today, now that I'm a trained four-wheel driver.
You should be speaking in that register whenever you drive the four-wheel drive.
Absolutely. one of the best things the guy did was, he talked me up a hill and I stuffed it up and he goes, okay, now we're going to do it again, but you're going to talk us through exactly what you're doing and why you're doing it. And it's, I must admit, I didn't finish my university degree, but I've lectured in all the big Melbourne universities as a guest lecturer now. I didn't ever study music, but I shouldn't name her name, but our prep music teacher, who's just a lovely woman, she came to one of my professional development days and I taught her how to teach. the point I'm trying to make is not that I'm good. The point is that I'm the sort of person who would rather teach than learn because I learn by teaching.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it's one of those things that's proven. You retain 90% of the information that you teach someone else.
Yeah.
So that's probably, you know, I guess it's twofold, but he's smart in making you talk through it and explain it to someone else because then you're much more likely to retain it.
You put it in your own words, you put it in your own neural links.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think also there's like that factor of, you know, like a natural, that that some of us are natural mentors or natural, we naturally want to sort of share things with people. I think that that's true, that for a lot of people that's quite a gift and quite an urge, you know, to sort of, and teaching through doing is kind of fundamental, I think, to good teaching.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I've got a lot of friends who are teaching at a, people teaching at a primary level, and it gets thrust upon them. It's like, all right, I'm your teaching recorder next term, or you're teaching ukulele next term, and you know, they get really stressed, and you're like, all you got to do is be good enough for the first lesson. Like that's it, and then all you've got to do is be good enough for the second lesson.
Stay the chapter ahead. Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's great. I mean, I learned so much about singing, teaching singing, and once again, I never did singing lessons as such. I've probably had four singing lessons in my life, I reckon. But once I started teaching, I was thinking all week. I was thinking about why. I was thinking about why does your voice do that? Why does your...
How do I unpack this?
Yeah,
for
and
my
how
students?
Can I turn that into an exercise? How can, you know, like in the gym, right? I want to isolate my biceps. So I hold this, you know, I have to pin my elbow to my hip so that it's isolating the bicep and not the shoulder. So it's the same thing with singing, right? How do I isolate that? Like, how can I stop them doing all those other things? And that, yeah, it changed the way I sung. It changed everything about my own technique.
And I think that's the sort of core thing that you see with really engaged teachers is that there's part of you that's always thinking about it. You don't ever switch off. You know, people talk a lot about teachers having lots of holidays, but I think that's actually good brain time to kind of unpack what you need to, what you actually need to.
Stop thinking about other people's shit for a while and start thinking about your own shit.
And start doing stuff so that you can work out how to unpack it for others, you know, that sort of thing.
And there's also that staying ahead, like you want to you want to teach people. It's not just teaching people lesson plans or preparing them for their next round of NAPLAN you know, testing, which I believe was today. For the year threes, fives and sevens.
And nines.
Nines, yeah. Yep. I don't know why I know that.
It was on the radio, I think.
It's on the radio.
Yeah.
Because I was in the four-wheel drive ahead
of
radio.
Yeah, there you go, yeah.
I couldn't get my podcasts to work. yeah, like it's more than that. It's about teaching people how to be a good person as well. Like you're in a classroom showing children how to be good adults. So how do you do that? You got to go home, have a holiday, remember what it's like to be a normal person who's not dealing with young
get
people.
Get some work-life balance.
All the time.
Yeah, exactly.
It's really important.
Yeah, it is really important. And I think it's like, you know, we've talked a little bit about, you know, whether you live to work or work to live or, you know, what the role of work is. And it is quite amazing the way it gives you such a strong sense of purpose when you're doing something you're happy to be doing, you know. But I also wonder if it's a bit like, you know, when you, I don't know, when I first went to Rome, I thought, gee, I could live here. I love it. Then when you actually think about living somewhere, that's a different thing to being on holiday there, you know, and you start to think, well, would I actually sort of murder anywhere I lived because I'd have to work there and sort of do ordinary things there, like go to the shops and
different
buy toilet
places.
Paper.
The expectation of your work hours is very different. You go to Taiwan, you work 90 hours a week. You come to Australia, you're paid overtime after 40, in theory.
Yes.
I know I know. In your profession, you're probably laughing, 40 hours. And then the people out there go, well, you get good holidays.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But
anyway,
I think it
is
like an interesting thing,
There's lifestyles. Like in Spain, you can have a siesta.
Yeah.
You
know, which apparently they're planning on abolishing.
Well, it's stupid, Peach. Stupid, because it's a good idea.
It is a really good idea.
They've placed in some of the Scandinavian countries, they've cut back to six-hour days and they've showed that productivity has gone up. Across the board.
I can really believe that, especially when you're living somewhere that gets dark so early in the winter. That just must be really, I think, really depressing, and it must be really important to be home and cuddled up and sort of hibernatory, I think.
Not just that. I mean, you know what it's like, the last period after lunch, for example, when people come in, like, or at the end of term or something, like you're treading water.
Yeah.
You know, you're not, people aren't learning a lot more. You're like, we're just killing time so that, you know, they can get home and not be at home on their own for a long time.
Yeah.
There's a great sense of that. And I don't think it has to be like that because mum and dad could be home by three.
Yeah.
As well.
Yeah. Wouldn't like, that be nice? Yeah.
We all know what it's like going into the office.
Mm.
I mean, I've never really worked in an office, so I can't really.
I love the way you say, we all know. We all know what it's like, except me. Yeah.
Well, I do. I do work in an office. But, I mean, my life's kind of funny because I don't have real jobs as such. I have
You're not having a corporate existence.
No.
You did for a while there, many years ago.
No. But I often, like, I deliberately leave work at like 3 o'clock, and you know my bosses are great because they know I'm very productive when you know when I do my stuff. I leave, I go home, and I do some more work later, so I can spend time with my fiance. I can get some work done on my pizza oven while it's still light. I can, you know, like you there's real life stuff you can
see
be
your
doing.
People, you walk the dog, whatever you need to do,
and do some emails later, send some stuff out, do your database or
but I guess the other argument for that, against that, is that that's that perpetual bracket creep of, you know, work into every hour of your life. Or like one of my colleagues was talking about the fact that he's just got a brand new Subaru, you know, straight off the boat. And he said, oh, can do things I just didn't even know cars could do. It's just staggering. Anyway, he's worked out how to turn the Bluetooth on. He's like, it's got Bluetooth. I didn't know cars could have Bluetooth. And I'm like, oh, that's...
My car talks to me.
No, and this is the thing he said did his head in, because he turned on the Bluetooth and suddenly he was getting all of his work emails in the car and they were being read out to him by this robotic voice, and he was trying to just drop his kid off at school and it was becoming this like sort of weird. He said, I've started to feel guilty if I don't turn it on, because it's like this could be very good productive time right now in the car that I could be listening to my emails. And I think that's interesting too. You know, where do you, you know, I have a bit of a thing where I just refuse to have my work emails on my private phone because I don't want to have them constantly in my face, because of course I'll feel obliged to respond. So I don't know. I think it's interesting.
Honestly, you've just got to set your own limits. I mean, people in certain professions, people need to be able to get in touch with you. So, but they can call. Mm. You know, my thing is if someone sends me an email, they've got my number.
Yeah, if it's urgent, they'll call you. Exactly. Yeah.
It'll be 2 days. In fact, like if they email me on a Thursday afternoon and I'm taking Friday off, and I might take Monday off as well, I might have other things to do. I shouldn't say I take them off. I do other things on those days, but I try and work 3 days a week for this one job. But it might be three or four days.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Get around to it.
Yeah.
And if it's more urgent, just pick up the phone and, you know.
Exactly. Make it clear it's urgent. Yeah.
And I'll tell you I'm busy.
It's also quite interesting when you sort of – a lot of the stuff I've been reading about career and, you know, where you sort of work-life balance and all those sort of things suggest that the best work is work that you feel makes a difference, that is the work that will sustain you and is least likely to kind of, I guess, entirely drain your spirit, for want of a better word. But it's interesting when you talk to young people about that whole idea. A lot of them haven't even thought about it. They've thought about what sort of a lifestyle a career will give them, or what they're good at, you know. Mm. But they haven't thought about whether or not that will, I guess, for want of a better term, add value.
How do they know?
Well, that's interesting too. Well, I mean, maybe that needs to be discussed. Like maybe we need to talk about, you know, the value in different jobs and what they actually give people, you know?
My belief is it's all an illusion. Like what one person gets out of, like for me, for example, I had 10 years where I worked my ass off trying to make a go out of the music industry. And, you know, if I do a bit of sort of deep self-analysis, there was part of me that loved it because it was hard, because it was something that wasn't achievable and I was going to prove that I could do it. But then after 10 years of doing it, it was like, oh, well, I did that. But I had that same thing. I'm like, well, but it's all about me. Like it's about getting people to cheer and clap every 3.5 minutes. And that eventually that wasn't enough. It changed. And it always changed. People who are doctors, they work their ass off because they want to help people. And then they end up in a clinic handing out antibiotics and or telling people, you know, writing medical certificates for people because they've got a cold.
Mm.
Like every profession at the end of the line is fucking boring. Like you end up, once you've learned everything. Boring
bureaucracy,
yeah. Once you've learned all the things, you've gone through that really challenging, rocky part. It's just once you hit that cruise spot, you need more. Mm. And the best jobs are the ones that let you change, let you move sideways, let you take on extra roles. And
Or let you use that expertise to help others. You know, that's when you really start thinking about, okay, well, how do I now explain this to people? You know, I think mentoring people in your own profession is a really interesting, is such a big learning. We talk about this often, you know, that the peer observation is a really powerful learning tool too, because in watching someone else, whether they're doing it well or badly, doesn't really matter. You're going to learn something. You're either going to pick up something you hadn't. Yeah, exactly. You know, I think it's really...
Part of that's just about being a good person, isn't it? It's like someone comes to you for help or someone, like I get a lot of people coming to me saying, oh, I'm about to buy some equipment, or, you know, could you just, do you think I should buy this or this? And I'll, you know, I could just say, oh, buy that one. But, you know, I just think it's like a good person. I pick up the phone and go, oh, that's really good. What you should be thinking about is, you know, A, B, C. Mm. When we did this, we bought that one, but it turned out to be a bad decision for us because of A, B, C. Now, maybe you go, you know, you just, it being helpful isn't a career move or anything. Like being a good person is fulfilling in life. It's not necessarily about career, restricted to career.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Although I think that there's something about formalizing that relationship in the workplace, which can be quite powerful. You know, having been both a mentor and a mentee, I think it's quite an interesting.
Mentors. You know, They do. They do. They've done it forever.
Yeah.
So, you know, what is it about? What is it about? What are the things in your career that have marked that feeling of success or that feeling of like this is what makes it all worthwhile?
I don't know that I've really had. This is the thing. I'm not sure that I'm like a light bulb person. I'm not sure I've had like lots of moments where I've gone, oh, this is it. Yeah. Here we are. This is the marker. And you know, I often say to students and their families, you know, I'm a lot older than you and I still don't really know what I want to do. I'm not sure that everybody's driven or that everybody knows or that it, I'm not sure it's that crystal clear for a lot of us. We just sort of fall into things and you keep going. But
so many smart people say that, you know, the smartest people know that you know nothing. That's what I keep going on. I'm like, well, I must be really smart. I'm
really wise then. Yeah, exactly.
Because I don't know shit.
I think I'm deeply wise if that's the if that's the measure.
Then maybe you're not pitch.
Exactly. I don't know. And that's the other thing is that maybe it's just that I haven't really given myself the time to stop and think about those light bulb moments. Alain de Botton, who's one of my absolute just like favorite philosophers and writers. He wrote The Consolations of Work. And he talks a lot about that, about how, you know, yes, if work is meaningful, it gives you that sense of purpose and it can be really fulfilling and defining and give you a sense of identity and all of that. But I also wonder if that to some extent then, if it helps you define how you see yourself, then when you're without it, do you sort of come undone? Like I look at a lot of my friends who've left the workforce to have children or whatever and then find themselves sort of grappling with this empty void of like who am I now? Like am I defined by my children? Am I – and I don't know. I think there's a bit of – I think society does a bit of a disservice putting as much weight as we do on what we do,
Especially to women. Honestly, like when women get judged by other women for staying at home and giving their kids
a good life. Or not staying at home or not. Exactly.
Like guys don't judge women for that. Maybe they do. Maybe I'm just grossly – I am. I'm actually grossly generalizing because I don't know. But the fact is I watched my sister-in-law go through that exact thing. Like she was a super smart girl, went to uni, was super enthused about environmental issues and whatever. And then all of a sudden she was at home with babies and she didn't think that was enough. She had this identity crisis, like, oh, I've succumbed to being one of those people I didn't want to be. And it's like, where would we be if people didn't spend time nurturing the next wave of leaders?
Regardless of gender. Regardless of gender. And so I don't know, you know, we often hear that particularly in Melbourne there's two things that most people will ask you as soon as you meet them. One is what do you do, and the other is where did you go to school, which is a very weirdly Melbourne-centric thing. But I think I've certainly learnt the hard way as a single woman that one of the things you don't really want to ask is what do you do? Because it's a deeply pedestrian thing to ask. And it doesn't actually define a lot of people just work doing something that they have to do to pay the mortgage, not necessarily something they love or are invested in. And so they don't really want to be defined that way. I don't know. It's very interesting.
I ask, but not because I want to put someone in a box. I'm just generally interested
in what other people do. Or
honestly, since we started doing the podcast, like everyone I talk to about anything, I'm like, I don't know anything about that. So
you'd be quite interesting. So come and talk to us.
Explain to me how that works. Like, what's the first 2 hours of your day? Like, what does that even mean? I mean, a lot of people are just like, it's just work, you know. So just turn up and do the
And what's minimum. Very standard for some people is, you know, quite incredible for others, you know. And I, you know, a particular friend of ours who we'll have on the podcast at some point is a vet, and you just talk to her about her day and the variety of what she's doing, you know, surgery on a dog one moment, you know, comforting the parents of a dying budgerigar the next, shoulder deep, you know,
in a horse the next.
Yeah, exactly. Like it's really varied, and she talks about it like it's just stock standard day stuff. And I think, wow, how do you manage that? You know, where do you even begin to get your head around what to prescribe for dog dandruff? I mean, I wouldn't, you know, like there is so little that I really do know, particularly about professions. And
but it's like people used to ask me what I do, and I've done lots of things in my life, but I'd say, oh, I'm a singer. And everyone in their mind has this picture of what being a singer is. Like,
yes.
Oh, that's so cool. So do you like tour? And you're like, you know, I go on tours. What, overseas? Yeah, I go on overseas. But what they don't, like, it's not like, I sit in front of my computer most of the day sending emails and making phone calls, trying to line up work, talking to agents, sending out mail outs to schools to run it. You know, like, every job, it doesn't matter what it is, there's the good bits and there's the hard slog bits that don't inspire you, but it's, you know, it balances out in the wash.
I often had that conversation with kids who think they want to be physiotherapists, you know, and in their mind they've got this sort of funky, cool massaging in the footy room, in the club rooms, you know, kind of idea. I'm like, no, actually 90% of your job will be pumping the phlegm out of an old lady's chest in hospital. You know, do you actually want to learn that technique? And if you say that, you can instantly see whether this is fantasy or whether it's a real thing that they want to do, you know? Yeah.
It's a great example. Something like physio, osteopathy, podiatry, there's this ideas explosion when you study, because you study everything and you're prepared to deal with every ailment. You learn every bone and muscle in the body and every tendon. And then, you know, 4 or 5 years down the track, you know, you carve your own sort of groove, whether it's you're working with children or old people or recovery from sports injuries. It's all the same injuries.
Well,
it's tendonitis of the jumping knee. It's it's all the same thing again and again. So
like my physio said, she said she just has people walk through the door and she's like, oh, here's another ass. Here's another elbow. Here's another hip. You know,
And all that stuff that originally was like, you know, when you really enjoyed explaining it to someone, like by the 700th time, it's a spiel. And it's a finely tuned spiel and you're not wasting any words and it's just like dribbling shit.
But at the same time, is that when you're at your most refined, like, you know, what we were saying off air before, you know, is that the point where you're actually doing the best job you've done, when you've done it so many times that you're actually at that tipping point where it's second nature? Is that when you're the best? You know, like, because a heart surgeon, that's probably when I'd most want him to do my heart. Not when it's a new thing for him, but when it's down to, you know what I mean?
Sure.
But I think for a lot of things.
But you go to a physio, I swear by the time I take myself to treatment, because I'm much more of a like preventative health person, and then as soon as I know something's wrong, I try and fix it myself and, you know, I try and avoid doctors. And I've got an in-house one, which really helps. but I feel like if you're in the business of wellness in a holistic sense, you can explain all that information really succinctly and quickly, but that's not necessarily what's needed. You need to take care of a patient and listen to a patient. And even though you've heard it 100 times before, listening and making them feel like they're important is actually more important.
The thing is, though, you won't have heard it 100 times before. I mean, that's what you realize in those helping professions.
Oh, is that you may have heard something. Lower back, and it's funny because my hamstrings are really tight. Like, you've got to pretend that that's, oh, your hamstrings. Oh, well, that's interesting because that could affect your lower back. And your calves are probably getting a bit tight too. And you might have a bit of pain down your sciatic nerve, which runs down. Like, there's two. Do you get better at the actual job, or do you just stay good helping people be well? They're two really different things.
Do you think they are?
I think they are. Oh. I've been to that many doctors and you walk in and it's not, they're like not even listening to you. Like, And as you're talking about your symptoms, they're already writing the script. And it's like.
But I also wonder if that is a product of a system which no longer allows doctors time to talk to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, I often feel like I'm in sort of a factory lineup when I'm at the GPs, don't you? Like,
I've had a great GP for so long. His name's Dr. Lionel Wu. and I just got a letter in the mail saying he's moving. Now he's like, it'd be 35 minutes on the train or probably 20 minutes in the car, whereas it used to be a short walk to his clinic. And I saw him through all of my stuff after a serious car accident. So I had to go in and get a lot of certificates signed, a lot of scripts of anti-inflammatories and painkillers and stuff like that. And because I was dealing with TAC, you just have to constantly go back and get everything certified. Justify yourself,
yeah.
Never charged me a cent. Bog billed everything. Even once I got better, he was still happy to go, you know. Had a great doctor. And I'm really, the whole thrust of my story is he's gone. He's leaving me. And now I have to either drive or.
It's probably worth driving. They're hard to find.
It could be.
GPs you like. But or now you're living with one.
Every now and then I'm with my partner and I think she's being really affectionate. And then I kind of.
Realize she's inspecting you.
Yeah, she's just like checking out a mole or something.
What's going on with that mole? Yeah.
I've just got to start trying to grow some moles around my genitals. Cashing on it. I think this one's getting bigger, darling.
Oh, dear.
Yeah.
I appear to have a growth.
So back to my question from a while ago. Maybe what I'm asking is not so much about light bulb moments, but like surely you don't just do what you do because you can't be bothered quitting. Like you're a talented person. What makes you feel good about it? What are your small victories?
Look, I think the thing is that, well, what keeps me going back is that no 2 days are ever the same, and I do appreciate that variety.
It's massive. Than a lot of
people exactly. And then there's just those little moments where you. I mean, it's all. I mean, the whole job really is relationship building. So it's just little moments where you. You know, where somebody bothers to thank you or where, you're in the right place at the right time for a student. Today I had a student come to see me to talk to me about his subjects and what he was really worried about a particular subject. And it was, you know, within about 30 seconds I realised it wasn't about the subject, that he was actually just really having a bad couple of weeks and feeling really stressed, and that it wasn't about that at all. And I think for me, like, that counselling side of my role is really, I really enjoy that. I really think that that's valuable, and I really like connecting not just with a student but with their whole family and kind of finding out about that side of their life, because it's all so interconnected, you know.
Absolutely.
And I think often you can find yourself operating in a bit of a vacuum unless you do make those connections. And then there's, like, you know, the sort of other side of my job, which is the actual classroom stuff. And I just I love seeing it come back to me times 10, you know. If I've made a suggestion and it comes back.
What's your process like? I know these days, like, probably when you start, you've got to do lesson plans and stuff, and the longer you go, you're like, I got this.
But, like, I remember my first teaching round was at a particular secondary school that only did VCE.
Yeah.
And my mentor was this incredible woman who would just, I thought she was incredible. She wore sort of leopard skin boots, and she would just shove a whiteboard marker in her top pocket and walk into class. And I'd be like, oh my God. And I would have spent, you know, 3 days preparing for the same lesson, and she'd be there giving this much more dynamic sort of lesson. And to some extent, I think I'm at that point now where I can just walk in with a whiteboard marker, because I've realized too, it's not so much about me as it is about them, you know. It's actually, and in particularly fact, with something creative, you know.
Yeah, and I found when I did my singing, when I taught singing for a long time, the best classes, every time, the best classes are the ones that I didn't plan, the ones that I didn't, like, oh, what exercise am I going to do? All right, I'm going to feel this 60 minutes. It's going to be like bang, 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 bang. And if I did that, it was fine. We got through all those things. But it was too rigid, and that the student, you know, when a student turns up, it's like, okay, did you do your homework? And if they say yes, you're like, oh, great, let's hear it, cool. And then you go, right, we've moved. Okay, so now you need this lesson, right?
Mm.
Whereas if it's all planned,
if they say no, you've got to respond differently. It's like,
do the same stuff that we did last time. Well,
yeah.
But I always found that the best lesson, and it was the same when I used to coach volleyball as well. I used to coach volleyball on Monday afternoons at a time in my life when I was going out on Friday and staying out, you know, until
Monday morning.
Until Monday morning. And then, like, turning up and coaching, you know, VCE or, yeah, senior volleyball at the high school. And it's the same thing. Like, I was awesome. I'd really surprised myself. But the more that I felt, the less I felt like I had to prove myself, and the more that I could just be and react to the situation, the better I was as a coach and as a person. Every time that I was, my headspace was just stressing about sticking to a plan, or, you know, feeling like I've got to give people value and I'm not worthy of their time or their money or whatever. Like, it's a bad headspace to be in.
That's really not good.
They're paying you to be there and be an expert and react and share your experience,
And I think you get better at going in and letting them show you what they need. You know, like, I've got much better at being diagnostic, saying, okay, show me what you know now, and being like, okay, well, these are the holes, let's fill them, sort of thing, or these are the bridges you might need to get to the next bit.
Yeah. Mm. And do you ever leave a class, you know, that, I don't know, like, feeling like you didn't come through and just, like, you know, be driving home and go,
oh, I should have done that.
That's what I think. Yeah. And then come back, like,
yeah.
When are those times for you that that you have, I don't want to call them light bulb moments because they seem a bit confronting to you.
Yeah.
But like, are there particular times, like they talk about as an artist, it's when you go to bed and you're trying to sleep is when you get your best ideas.
Yeah.
You
know, that often, sort of... often, yeah. It's weird. I actually had a dream about one of my classes the other night, that we went on this big sort of, like, road trip. and up the Great Ocean Road. And at some point along the Great Ocean Road, I let them get out on the beach and they all sort of chose a particular character to act. And I told the kids about it today and they just said to me, that's pretty creepy, miss. Mm. I was like, yeah, it is creepy, but it's that thing again where your brain's always on it. Light bulb moments, as in light bulb moments as in things I should have done or things I did do?
Just ideas, like
I often have that, mostly in the car actually. Like mostly driving, it's really good thinking time for me, and particularly in the mornings when I'm sort of like my brain isn't quite switched on and I'm sort of half there and half, you know, sort of, I don't know, it's a good time for me to come up with things. But I still walk out and think, yeah, how could I have done that better? And maybe that's also what makes the job so dynamic and so satisfying, is that because no days are ever the same and the classes are never the same, you always do have to think of ways to do it differently. Sometimes you like click onto a way where you think, oh, that's a really good way of teaching this particular concept. And you think, oh, this just works with all my groups. And then inevitably you get a group and they just don't.
Doesn't resonate.
Yeah. For whatever reason, that doesn't connect with them. So you've got to find another way around it. I'm also finding the older I get, the less relevant I am. Just in general. You know, as an older woman, you get less and less relevant. But I think I used to make a lot of, like, cultural references that connected the kids with me. I could say, you know,
your Seinfeld references don't have any culture. Exactly,
like yada 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 the Simpsons, you know, and they'd all be with me, but not anymore. It's all, you know, I don't know much about Minecraft.
My nephew watches videos of other people playing Minecraft. I get stuck into him about that. But then at the same time, I spend my whole childhood watching my two brothers play the computer because they wouldn't let me play.
Yeah, so I did exactly the same. So the same sort of thing in a way. Yeah, exactly.
Just passive entertainment.
I just watched The Toothbrush Family on repeat, really. I remember doing that. Did you ever watch The Toothbrush Family?
Yeah.
I love that show. Oh, my God, Susie Spongeface.
Yeah.
And that, like, really the dog toothbrush that was all, like, scruffy.
Yeah, don't bring this up in the classroom.
This isn't
going to get you anywhere.
That's exactly the thing. Like, I'll talk randomly about The Toothbrush Family and everyone just looks at me like I'm completely bizarre. Yeah. I don't see how it's that much stranger
TV's
than,
got
like,
good since your days,
Teenage
Peach.
Mutant Ninja Turtles, you
wow,
know.
That's still there. Transformers is still there.
Yeah, I know.
He-Man's surely due for a comeback.
He'll be back soon. Yeah, exactly.
He-Man.
Yeah, yeah. It's interesting. It's also interesting, like, with fairy tales where
they're all vaginal from what I've heard.
Oh.
I did this subject at university. They're all about childhood literature. And this 60-year-old woman was our head lecturer, doctor, someone. And
it's all about vaginas.
Oh, everything's about vaginas.
Really?
Oh, Hansel and Gretel. Oh, what do you think he was, what, you thought it was really an oven he was being pushed into? No, that was a vagina, dear.
Oh, God.
Oh, the whole
suddenly
house,
Hansel
the whole
and Gretel.
Gingerbread house was a whole bloody vagina, apparently.
Oh, my God, how disturbing. Wow.
Yeah, I
so little Hansel eating little bits of the house. That was a sort of
it's a cunnilingus.
Wow, God, how disgusting! Oh, I'll never do Hansel and Gretel again with the Year Sevens.
Oh, but it didn't matter. It didn't with this woman. It didn't matter what you talked about. You know, you could be like, you know, Dostoevsky, vaginal.
There's something to be said for that, though. Yeah. The universal
war
cunt.
War is the vagina, peace is the penis, and, you know, they're just going
to
do their thing.
Oh, I'd like to reverse that image.
Oh, sure. Well, that's fair. That's fair. I think that history shows that's fair.
That is indeed.
I retract my my penile.
Do you think that's
metaphor.
Why you have to go to uni and do an undergrad, though, to, like, realise that Freud is still relevant? Or...
I don't think I've ever had a problem like finding penis references in
or vaginal references. No. Although the gingerbread house does seem to me to be a little bit of a push. So what were they?
Red Riding Hood.
Were the crumbs?
Oh, what do you think? Her hood. Her hood, Peachy. It's a hood. A clitoral hood.
Oh wow! Really?
Yeah.
Oh God.
Amazing.
What a woman. We should get her on.
It's a whole career.
We should get her on the show. Career. Exactly. Talk to her about how she makes meaning in her daily work life.
Traumatizing 17-year-olds with
who think they've got it all worked out. Yeah. No, you don't, little ones. You really don't. Oh, dear.
Yeah, crazy stuff.
It's a whole new spin on the moral lesson behind Red Riding Hood.
Vaginal. Or vaginal. What is it?
I don't think it matters.
I was thinking in the shower the other day, like, vaginal sounds more like what an Australian would say, and vaginal is more like what an American would say.
That's probably true. They would probably say vaginal.
Vaginal warts.
Vaginal. I don't think they'd say vaginal.
Vaginal warts.
Oh, God.
That's not a nice thing. Yeah. Surely we've got something better. I'll tell you what, Peachy, you know what really gets my goat? And I've been meaning to bring this up with
you for
a while.
Is this a logical leap from vaginal?
Not at all.
Right, okay.
It got me thinking, well, I've been thinking about this for a long time. In fact, I sort of want to write a book because I think I think about this more than most people think about. But there was an article in the paper the other day about...
They say write the book you want to read, Chris, so go for it.
Right? But when you're such an expert as me, you don't need to read it. You don't want to read it. You just want other people to understand what you understand. Yeah. It's a public service.
I see.
There was an article about in London, they've put public service announcements out to say that that people should no longer, because of traffic flow at London tube stations, and Londoners have always had this terrific thing they do on escalators where if you want
to
you stand on the left. Mm. If you want to walk, you go on the right. Mm. Makes a lot of sense to me.
The Brits have some very good etiquette with things like that, and it's always go move to your left. And I have found increasingly that people move to the right and or walk just in front of you. It's very annoying.
Oh. And I make like loud mouth noises and stuff.
Oh, do you?
Like I don't like.
Do you tut, Chris? Are you a tutter?
I will. I'll just say excuse me. But sometimes people don't get it. You can tell where tourists are in Australia because tourists walk on the right and locals walk on the left. You know?
That is true. That's very true. There's quite a horrifying experience of mine. going up Davey Street in Hobart. So in Hobart, the city centre is crisscrossed by a series of one-way streets. It's a little bit like Sydney, you know, because they're old, you know, big wide streets, much wider than Sydney, but still one-way. So, you know, the parallel streets, one goes one way, one goes the other way. Driving up Davey Street and this little hire car coming screaming down the road in the wrong direction. The most, like, against four lanes of traffic going the other way. The most horrifying, like, absolutely horrifying. That is, and you know when you're going along the Great Ocean Roads, you see those signs saying this side of the road and you think, oh, my God, it's the Great Ocean Road here. We're on a tight bend. If you're coming the wrong way, we're in trouble here, you know.
And it's like how many people had to do that before you put up a sign?
Exactly,
It's like if you ever read the fine print in a condom packet, they say, please do not return used products to the manufacturer.
Oh, my God.
How many condoms, used condoms, must they have received in the mail before they had to put that? Oh, maybe like... Look, this one has a hole in it. I only discovered it after I filled it with man juice or...
Oh, my God, please never say man juice. It's disgusting. Ew.
I promise I'll never say man juice again. The word man juice shall never be uttered.
That's appalling.
Yeah.
Anything with juice at the end is kind of gross.
Like, we have this, yeah. What about apple juice? That's all right.
Yeah, it's also kind of a bit squeamish when you've just said man juice.
Association. Do you want some orange juice, Peachy? So, like, we have this whole driver etiquette thing we talk about in this road rage and whatever, but I'm about pedestrian etiquette.
So you've thought about this so much that you actually have a term for it.
The older I get, like, I'm that grumpy old man who walks around the streets, and I'm always in a hurry. I've got very long legs, and when I'm going from A to B, I'm like a...
Get out of my way.
Let's get there. And then start being in the moment. Like I'm very – now, I don't mind if other people want to walk slowly. That's
fine. You don't
mind
the moseyers?
No. What I mind,
get out of my way.
For example, is what I call the drifter. The drifter is someone who in a straight road is walking slowly and drifting sideways, like walking diagonally.
I think I may be a drifter. I'm just confessing to you now, Colonel, that I think I am one of those people.
Look, you don't have to admit it. Like, just talking about it means that maybe we can all think about it a little more.
Start thinking about who we are, yeah.
Well, like, like people walking along the right side of the road, which is fine. I don't mind which side of the road people walk.
Oh, really?
But they want to go into a shop on the left. Mm. So they're on the left they're side of the road. They're going to be cutting across. They're on the right side of the footpath. Yeah. There's no thought process about the fact that they're going to be cutting across other people. Mm. They don't look. They just
They have drift. No form of indication.
They just drift.
They just do it. Yeah.
And
they can cause serious chaos in the process. You know, they can pull you up. They can pull you up short with a coffee in your hand. I've had that happen many times where I've actually had the full collide, the side collide with somebody who's drifted into a shop.
And, you know, there could be pets involved. There could be prams, you know.
Yeah.
Or like similarly, the person walking out of a shop onto the footpath without looking. Like
you must look before you join the flow of traffic. Absolutely.
Exactly. Just like a car. Like you don't have right of way. Mm. You're entering... You're entering a road. I'm glad. I'm glad you see this.
No, totally. This seems quite logical. I'd read this book.
the phone, the texting, you know, people on their phone, they're zombies. This is a nightmare. They're
zombies. It really is a nightmare, the phone thing.
With their face down looking at their hands and expect that everyone else should just, adjust? Everyone else should have their heads up so that you can look down?
Mm.
It really, really annoys me.
And you often see the way, you often know when there's somebody like that coming the other way because people start to part around them.
Yeah.
Have you noticed that? Yeah. Like a weird wave thing?
See, I'm the guy who, if you're walking to me, or towards me with your phone down, I deliberately walk at you just to prove a point so that when you look up at that last minute.
You're in my face. Like,
oh, sorry. I'm right there.
Yeah.
And I'm large.
Yeah.
You know.
You are large. Yes. Even if you were small, you'd be making a point.
Yeah.
Mm. And I think that's interesting because today I had quite an interesting moment just near here actually on a very suburban footpath, you know, very suburban. This is not like a busy shopping strip or anything, just a very suburban street, you know, walking along.
Should work.
And there's a man stopped in the middle of the footpath, in the middle. Staring intently at a receipt with his shopping bag out in front of him. Now, why he'd chosen to stop at that moment to check that receipt, I don't know. He was at least 600 metres from the shop.
No.
There was no rhyme nor reason. But he looked up and he looked at me and he stayed right where he was so that I was then forced onto the nature strip to avoid receipt-looking man. How rude. How dare he? Where has courtesy gone? Dear listeners, please post on Facebook. Together. Tell us where you think you have found the rudest pedestrian who is breaking, what are we calling
pedestricate.
It? Pedestricate. I can't say it's flowing off my tongue yet, but it will.
I think what you're talking about is a stopper. They're just there's someone who walks and then without any care of those people around them or the speed differentials of those coming towards or coming from behind, think that whatever's going on for them is more important and they just stop. I went to the MCG the other day, to the footy, and there was a group of school kids and they were standing across, the entire group was standing across the stairs, covering the entire entranceway to the stairs. That gives me the shits. Well, people standing in a busy, like people get to the bottom of a stairwell and three or four people mill and have a conversation.
Yes, like, milling.
Have you no awareness?
Yes, milling in doorways really is a bit, or at the bottom, or on staircases in general is problematic. Oh. You often see that at the theatre too when people do that sort of standing milling thing to wait to sit down in their seat till the last minute. And, you know, there's some poor old chook who wants to actually use the handrail, but there are people rudely standing against the handrail. And it just doesn't work, you know. I don't think it. Yeah, sorry, I didn't mean to sound disparaging to the old chook, the old woman,
who it's might be coming down. You're encouraging them to use the rail.
Exactly, and they should be using the rail so they don't fall. Come, you know, and especially in some of the theatres in Melbourne where they're quite steep.
Mm.
You know, it's quite a steep. Yeah. The milling thing is interesting though, because I do think when you're referring to adolescents, you know, as a teacher, they really don't actually get it.
And maybe a book, maybe you could help me get it on the syllabus.
Yes.
For every school.
Yeah, a bit of pedestricate teaching. Just the same way we teach them bike rules. Maybe we should be teaching them to stand to the left. Well, I actually think that's quite, because there is a real lack of awareness of others that happens in adolescence. And it's not, you know, none of the students I teach would I consider generally to be, none of them would be, you know, sort of rude public transport users or anything. They'd be the sort of people who would probably get up. But sometimes they'd need it pointed out to them that they needed to get up, you know, because they're just unaware because they're buried in a phone or they're, you know, absorbed with their little friends. They don't realise that they're standing across a stairwell or, you know. And I've become such a teacher that I just do that in real life now. I just walk up to people I don't know and say, excuse me, you need to move, in a teacher voice. And amazingly, most adolescents respond to that.
Well, it's their whole life is people telling them what to do. They're kind of
sort of awful, isn't it?
It's fascinating. This I heard it on a podcast. In fact, I've heard it on two or three different podcasts.
Mm.
There was this guy, this scientist, and he was studying serial killers, psychopaths.
Mm.
So he'd been for many, many years profiling psychopaths and working out what it is that made psychopaths psychopaths, and he worked it out. And in doing so, for part of the studies, so he went into all the prisons, to all the known psychopaths and did all these interviews, and then he needed control subjects.
Mm.
So he put himself forward as a control subject, and what came back was that he was a psychopath. And so, you know, he was kind of like, well, there's something wrong with the studies. And then as part of the interview, it wasn't just interviewing him or just not just interviewing the criminal in the jail. It was interviewing all their family as well about behaviours that they expressed. And slowly as they interviewed everyone in his life, they were like, well, yeah, to be honest, he's a very thoughtless guy. Like, he doesn't really notice the world around him. He's very self-absorbed. And he had all the traits of a psychopath. And it was fascinating.
Which is maybe why he was interested in them.
Possibly. I mean, he had this whole, that's not really how it came to be. Like, he wasn't trying to understand himself better. It was just this amazing coincidence that this guy, smart enough and accomplished enough as a scientist, you know, to do this study, just happened to be the very thing he was studying.
Mm.
So the good thing was he had the awareness to say, well, so what is it about it? So he had all these interviews about him and he's reading, he's like, yeah, my wife's right. Like, you know, if they were sitting at the table, like we are, drinking a glass of wine, he'd never offer to pour her a wine. Like, he'd just look after his own little world and just do his thing. So he made the conscious decision to go, okay, well, now that I know this, I want to not be a psychopath. So he started actively thinking about the world around him, actively thinking about his pedestricate, things like that, thinking about how he was handling his wife. And he said, compared to how he was...
Handling his wife.
That's a bad turn of phrase. Compared to how he was, he said life was so difficult now that he had to consider
other people,
everything else. And he was like, it went from, he was a very accomplished kind of mad genius scientist who just had this natural rhythm and did his own thing, published his own papers. He's like, I couldn't have done that if I wasn't self-absorbed.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. I'm just having
So should we be teaching people out of it or should we be teaching people? It's hard to know.
The fact is we live in big cities. Like, it's a very basic need to be able to live around millions of other people and not piss people off.
Mm.
You know, to be able to spread a bit of joy. Like, if we're all clambering over each other and, you know, being freaking drifters and standing on the right of escalators and stuff, like, people are unnecessarily getting upset about it. Now, you might say to me, stop being upset about it, you know, whatever. But there's simple things that we can do, like we do on the road, You know, we stick, we don't go in the right lane unless we want to overtake. Now, that's a, you know, that's just a simple road etiquette thing. It saves lives. It stops you having situations of impatience and stuff.
Yeah.
There's ways that we can live together that make it better for everyone. Mm. Now, I'm a utilitarian, and I think anything that I can do to, you know, to make the greater good.
You're a utilitarian.
Oh, wouldn't you say so?
Oh, no. Oh, no? That's interesting.
Why is that?
Well, I'm an Epicurean. They have very different ways of looking at the world.
Oh, I just think, well, the greater good for the greater number.
Oh, like, I believe in the social forum, let everybody talk, but I don't know.
Sure, but for example, I'm walking along a crowded street and I'm on the left of the footpath and there's a lot of people walking fast and I want to get over to the right. I would sooner just pull over to the left, stop, let the people want to go past and then walk across because it'll be a bit slower for me, but in terms of the traffic flow, it'll be better for the greater number of people.
Hmm.
I think that makes sense.
It does. It makes perfect sense. Yes. You know. And I agree with you that the more urban we become, the more these little things actually do become a real issue and do become something that needs to be mandated so that that's what you do, you know, so that when you're in London, well, that's the way you do it.
Mm.
And it should really be something that you do everywhere.
It's like in cars, right? If we see a speed camera, you know, we flick our lights at oncoming traffic to let them know that there's the speed camera coming up. I'm sure it's illegal, but, you know, we do it.
It is,
it's a service that we offer to people that we don't even know. Like it's a kindness kind of thing. If someone's driving at night and they don't have their lights on, we do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
If someone's driving and they've left their indicator on but they clearly don't want to change lanes, or what can you do? Like the only tool that we have, it's like being stuck in a wheelchair where all you can do is blink, you know.
I don't know the about guy that simile. In
Breaking Bad who can just ring the bell, you know. It's like it seems, given the technology that we have at our disposal, surely somebody could just put out a meme and say, okay, one flash, that means your lights are off. Two flashes, that means the cop car's coming. Three flashes, your indicator's on. Like, surely we can come up with a
system.
Four
flashes, you're drifting.
Yeah.
Wake up.
Get out of my fucking way. Surely, with communication the way it is today, surely we could come up with a system whereby we knew what those things meant. Truckies.
Mm.
Apparently with truckies, if you're driving behind a truckie and he's saying, I can see ahead, it's clear to pass, they'll chuck their right indicator on to say, you can go right. Once you've gone past, there's this etiquette where you're meant to go, oh, I can't remember what it is, but it's like you indicate left, then right, then left, just to say thank you very much. And if you don't do it, there's some truckie out there. And you didn't even know. You didn't even know that there was a rule, but there's some truckies like, oh, I fucking let you through. You didn't even do the left, right, fucking left thing, you dirty. Should be taught.
This is where the meme should come up. Or the book. The book. Publish the book. Publish the book. Absolutely. But look,
someone else can do the road stuff. I'm looking at specialising in the pedestrian area because I'm far more often a pedestrian. Public transport, you know, the things you can do there, it's the same thing. It's all pedestrian.
Public transport is very interesting. Seeing the way different people deal with being on a crowded tram or train is a very interesting thing.
Oh, there's one rule. Don't look at anyone. Don't talk to anyone. Stay out of the way. Don't smell bad.
Yeah, there's the big rule about, like, not groping someone and or sticking your armpit in their face.
It's not Japan. It's not Tokyo.
Well, no, I don't get the groping thing. Like, what is that?
Have you been groped?
Oh, yeah, many times on Melbourne trams. Yeah, it's quite awful. Damn. Yeah.
I never get groped.
Oh, well.
You always want what you can.
It's quite awful.
Yeah, I'm making light of something that's actually a
It's really gross. And especially when you can't really get out of the way, that's really awful.
At least here, if you said, oi, fuck off, stop groping me, I think at least 50% of people around you would go, yeah, get off her.
Yeah.
In Japan, they have a word for it. I can't remember what the word is, but there's a word for being felt up, molested on the train, and it's such a phenomenon because even if people are screaming, everyone's too polite to even acknowledge that it's going on. It's like, no, we're just going to keep doing the train thing, and the train thing is quiet and peaceful, and you want to scream, you know.
Your problem.
That's your problem.
Frightening, isn't it?
It's very scary. The fact that what we talked about language earlier, the fact that you have a word for that thing.
Oh, I know.
Does that make it like every girl knows, because there's a word for it, knows that that's just kind of their lot in life? Like that. Ooh, you expect yucky, to get fucking really Tamagotchi'd awful on the train? Or...
Tamagotchi!
Obviously, that's not the word, but it is a, you know, it's a Japanese word. It's a thing.
Well, it's a toy, yes. Yeah. It's a form of Tamagotchi-ing, I guess. Yeah. Yes. Interestingly, the one of the candidates for the Philippines president, I read this absolutely frightening thing during the week where he, a young female aid worker, was kidnapped and raped in the Philippines recently.
Hmm.
And he said, this is the mayor now running for president, he said, but she was so pretty, I think the mayor should have been allowed to rape her first. And this is somebody who's is in public office and is running for public office. And the article was essentially saying, you know, you think Trump's bad. You know, you think Trump's a misogynist. Get a load of this. This is what's being accepted in this culture.
It's not competition, though, is it?
No, but at the same time, I mean, it just shows you how insidious this stuff is and how frightening this, you know, sort of women as possession thing is in a lot of cultures.
Well, for the majority of human history.
Yeah, exactly. And it really is quite awful. From the time of
agriculture until now, you know, essentially.
Yeah. So perhaps it's not that strange that there's a word for it.
Yeah, I mean, with the word, because we have the word rape, I mean, that's a fucking horrible thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But we have a word for it because it happens so often that we have to save time when we talk about it.
Mm. Mm. And the fact that that many women have, like, died at the hands of somebody they love this year alone in Australia is...
But it's cool...
It's jaw-droppingly appalling.
I tell you, we all hate... You know, the corporations and, you know, this sort of sense that, you know, big companies are, you know, have so much control over the world. But a great example of how it's actually good was the boxer Manny Pacquiao. He had the fight of the biggest fight ever in boxing history. It was a $200 million boxing fight between him and Floyd Mayweather. And both of them were considered the very, very best at what they did. They fought. Manny Pacquiao lost, but Floyd Mayweather had a history of domestic abuse. He'd beat up his wife. He's a bad dude. He's illiterate. He just came off, even though he won, he came off looking like the arsehole of the century. Whereas Manny Pacquiao lost, but he came off, he said he'd donate all his prize money to domestic abuse victims. He, you know, did all this stuff, and he came off looking like an angel. Anyway, that's the backstory.
Mm.
Afterwards, he was asked in an interview about homosexuals. By global media. So it's not, he's Filipino. And so he'd be used to getting interviewed by Filipino news media, and that wouldn't even be an issue because people wouldn't even talk about it. You know, it doesn't exist. Mm. They're a Catholic society, whatever.
Mm.
So they asked him about it, and his answer was something along the lines of, well, you know, it says in the Bible that, like, sleeping with a man is as bad as sleeping with a dog. Like, you wouldn't sleep with a dog, would you? That's disgusting. That's what I think of homosexuals. Which would have been shared by the majority of his countrymen. Like, it was just a normal thing to say. I'm Catholic and, you know, that's what the Bible says. So, yeah, like, homosexuality is just as bad as bestiality. Anything else, you know?
Yeah.
It was very matter of fact.
Mm.
Nike, don't sponsor him anymore. Cut all ties straight away. These are multi-million dollar deals. You know, all these big companies that, you know, what it does is raise the global expectations.
Do you think it does?
Well, for Manny Pacquiao, it did.
Yeah.
He could have got on the rest of his career bagging homosexuality, talking about fags and puffs and being like raping dogs, and that would have been cool. But because of his contract with Nike and because they're a global company and they can't have one rule for the Philippines and another rule for the USA, it evens things up. Now, that guy, when he's asked about it these days, do you think he says the same thing? Fuck no. Like, it's leveling the playing field, this global communication we've got and these global companies.
But does
he
still believe it? I mean, maybe that's the thing. Maybe, I guess money talks and bullshit walks, but I don't know.
But the fact that if you could have Manny Pacquiao, one of the greatest boxers in the world, asked about homosexuality that's shown on TV in the Philippines and he says, they're people just like the rest of us. The impact that would have, that one little thing, this guy who's, sure, he punches people's faces for a living, but if you can get that person to say it, that's enough to springboard change.
That then changes
won't kill
things,
his career. Mm. Everyone's scared, like, oh, I don't want to. But it's proven, like, in the acting business and in all these fields, people who've come out and supported it, they haven't lost their careers. They got a lot of press out of it. They got, you know, they're seen as, gay friendly and LGBTI friendly. It's not a career killer anymore. It's the very thing that's made us all start talking about it and raised our awareness to the point where people aren't being abused the way they used to be as much. I know we've got a long way to go.
So not just corporations, but celebrity endorsement of an issue helps to change attitudes, you think?
Well, I guess my point was global media helps those platforms become, like, you can't have one rule for one country and one rule for another now. Like every news outlet, someone does an interview here, it gets translated into English and put on the English sites, and it gets translated into Spanish for the Spanish.
Yeah.
Everyone gets all the information.
Mm.
And that's just the difference now.
Yeah.
You can't do... You know, and it's the same for us. Like, we say our opinions here. Like, people are going to be unhappy with our opinions. You bank on that.
Of course.
So, because we're speaking what we believe to the entire world now. Like, there's no... It's not like we're speaking to Melbourne 18 to 35-year-olds who are into this or whatever.
Yeah.
It's just everyone.
Yeah.
It could be
anyone has access. Yeah.
And even if they don't want to listen to it, they have the right to publicly respond to any snippet of thing that we said that they
and
want
to
take
offended
out of.
By it.
Yeah. Even out of context or with us having a chance to retort or anything.
Mm.
Very interesting, very interesting world.
Mm. And particularly, I wonder what the tipping point is with those kind of key issues and value statements and things coming from celebrities, because I wonder at what point, you know, it's like, interestingly, the Catholic Church saying, you know, trying to tell Telstra that they no longer wanted Telstra to support marriage equality, that it wasn't, that it shouldn't be part of their business strategy to clearly support marriage equality. And you have to wonder at what sort of... Where does the church stop thinking that they can influence business? Or it's a very interesting, I mean, these blurry lines.
You know when? When they start paying tax again.
Mm.
That is the last piece of bullshit in the world. No, there's plenty of pieces of bullshit in the world. That's a bit of hyperbole. the fact is they believe they can do what they do because they're given the right. They're given the right to say you're above everyone else, even though, you know, in Australia, for example, I'm not sure how the tax system works in Australia, but in America, how many people have to stop publicly endorsing God before the churches? These churches, they're in stadiums. The pastors have these 20-bedroom mansion properties, like... It's not like they're poor preachers anymore or anything. Like, the money's not going to the poor.
Mm.
How long till they have to pay tax? And it's not a matter of, I think my beliefs are better than your beliefs. It's just, why do you not have to pay tax? It doesn't make sense. Because
you're a charity.
If the money's going to charitable purposes, sure, don't be taxed on that money. If the money's going to buying big houses and fancy cars and whatever for the local pastor, why isn't that taxed?
Mm.
Why is their luxury any
different to treated any else's.
Differently? All they do is like they're a salesman. Like that is the role of an evangelical salesman, and I know that's sensitive to some people, but you're selling something to people, and you're trying to get them on board and get them to give you money.
Mm.
It's not a free ride. You're asking, you want God's eternal salvation. It's going to cost you, and you take their money tax free, and you spend it on a house. It doesn't make sense. That's why they think they can influence things.
When you say get on board, I just instantly think, people get ready for the train that's coming.
Did you know that was number 23 on Rolling Stone's Greatest Ever Songs?
Really?
Yeah.
And that's a Christian evangelical song, is it not?
Mm.
I mean, that is absolutely. where its roots are.
It is.
It's interesting. Yeah. What do you think about that whole growth of Hillsong and those sort of evangelical churches in Australia?
I think... Look, I think churches were very much a cornerstone of what set up Australian societies. They're the people who've been looking after our elderly. They're the people who've been, building playgrounds for kids. Like, they've done so much, and the faith is dying out in our country, and it's leaving a vacuum. So there's all these people who used to have a community. You know, when I grew up, I wasn't short of a community because I had sport and music and school and whatever. But on Sundays, I had this little church community. Now, if I didn't have my other communities, that would have been like my only friends. So you get people who, live a bit further out, or, I speak to a lot of my partner's friends. I'm more isolated,
yeah.
A lot of overseas students, when they come to Australia, even if they're not Christians, but they go to Hillsong.
Mm.
And I asked a few of them, so did you grow up Christian? Oh, no. I'm like, why do you go to church then? Because all the Chinese people do. It's the best way to meet Chinese people. And it's a community.
Mm.
And they're happy to sing a few songs and chant a few bits and bobs. So I think, I think this world that we live in, we know that what we need is human contact. We know we need conversations. We know we need human touch. We need a hug. We need a smile. We need love. But what do? We go to work. We work in a lot of us work in a little cubicle, and then we go home. We eat our single serve light and easy because we're told we're fat and that's a problem. We go to the gym on our own and put our earbuds in, and then we go home on our own to a house. There's no community. Community is not a normal thing anymore.
Mm.
We need it. So, yeah, when someone comes along, they offer community. They offer some of the best music going around in Australia. Mm. I'm not saying the content of the music, but these bands are rehearsing and performing more than any other band in Australia because they do it 3-4 times a week.
Mm.
They have light shows. They've got the whole thing. Oh,
yeah, the whole. I mean, it's so theatrical. I'm amazed by the theatre of it all. Yeah.
Amazing. So good on them. Mm. I totally get why they're successful. Mm. It's not my thing, and I'm not, I'm so lucky that I have people like you in my life that I can sit down and talk to about my feelings and not feel alone in this world. And if people need to go to a stadium and clap their hands and speak in tongues to get that feeling, good on them. Good on them.
Hmm. It's interesting.
Yeah, it is very interesting.
Mm.
Peach, we've gone miles over time, but only because it's been so damn enjoyable.
Catching as always, up with you again. Colonel, yes, very nice.
Tonight's podcast has been fueled by the 2014 Le Chat Noir Rosé. It's a French wine.
It's particularly pleasant, Rosé.
It's really good. Mm. Another really nice dry. Mm.
It's got a cool label too. I like that cat.
Yeah, it reminds me of that poster, that famous French poster. What annoys me a little bit is that the it's written in English on the back, and I'd much prefer to look at it and not know what it says and go,
I'm it's so really cultured.
I don't know what it says, but I totally experienced it anyway.
Bonne nuit, monsieur.
Bonne nuit. Oui, oui. Yeah, any French people out there listening, thanks for all that wonderful things that you do with the wine. Portuguese people too, they do great wine. New Zealanders, awesome wine. Australians. Oh, it brings us all together. Ladies and gentlemen, I feel so blessed to just sit here and talk, and I don't even really care if people like listening to it because I just enjoy listening to it so much. Love you lots, Peach.
Oh, love you too, Chris.
Love you all out there who are tuning in, and especially those who are getting on our Facebook, facebook.com/peachinthekernel, our website, peachinthekernel.com. We're keeping it very simple for you. Who are jumping on, telling us their views about work-life meaning, about pedestricate, about Kernel's weekly and monthly challenges. Bring them on. Bring them on. Mm. Don't think I can do it.
I say, and perhaps what role faith plays for you in your daily life and community plays for you in your daily life, how you get your shot of community.
Yeah. Mm. And honestly, I've experienced faith in many ways throughout my life. I'm an atheist, but I would love to speak to someone who wants to tell me about their faith. And, you know, I'm not about pushing my beliefs on other people, as opinionated as I may come across. But I'd love to. I'd love to learn. So if you're interested, just get in touch through our website or through our Facebook. Anyway, lots of love to everyone out there. I hope you have your sense of community, and I hope you have your work-life balance, and I hope no assholes are stopping in the middle of the road talking on their phones while you're trying to walk down the street. That's all I can hope. Much love. Take care. Bye.